And I think that what is so, so critical is to realize that there is a force that's more powerful than any of those you mentioned, which is basically the force of our shared humanity and the force of billions of human beings who, at their core, at their heart, want to be part of a thriving, flourishing, healthy earth, want to be part of a healthy society. Actually, we as humans want happiness. We want love. We want connection. We want health all around us. And basically, the reason that's not been happening is because we are in a society which essentially brainwashes people to then learn to look for materialist values and sort of get on what's known as the hedonic treadmill.
Hello there. My name is Duncan Autry, and you are listening to Fractal Friends, the podcast where we explore our self-similarity across our diversity. We all have a role to play in the whole, and the purpose of this show is to interview people with interesting perspectives on the world and see what it is that we can learn from one another. In this episode, I talk with Jeremy Lent. Jeremy is an author and an integrator. His first book is called The Patterning Instinct, A Cultural History of Humanity's Search for Meaning. He also has an upcoming book called The Web of Meaning, Integrating Science and Traditional Wisdom. Jeremy calls himself an integrator, and I fully agree. His work is to weave together knowledge from across disciplines, cultures, and time. And he does this to give his life meaning, but also to bring meaning to all of our lives. I'm using this episode to launch season 3 of Fractal Friends because it lays the perfect groundwork for the themes that we are going to be covering in the next series of episodes. In this conversation, we talk about finding meaning in our personal lives and as a culture. And we find that it often comes down to being connected with others. And the take-home on meaning is this: what is meaningful in your life? Do more of that. We also dig into the cultural and ethical implications of developing a new and very ancient understanding of reality that understands the cyclical nature of things and that recognizes that we are, and we are part of, interdependent systems. And that brings us to a deep and nuanced exploration of the dance between science and spirituality. We reveal both where the tension is and where it is not. And, as is going to be a recurring theme this season, we talk about how the cultural integration of existing knowledge is going to be necessary for us to survive as a humanity through the times that we are currently in. Whether it's politics or racism, ecological threats, or the risk of losing ourselves in technology, we all need to recognize our interconnectedness and begin to actively start collaborating together to build the world that we want to live in. Thank you so much for listening to Fractal Friends. If you enjoy this show, please subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening to it and give it a review if you have a chance. Also, come visit fractalfriends.us. There's a lot of information in this episode from Jeremy and the things we discuss in this episode. Given the wide range of themes in this conversation, this episode page is specifically rich in resources. You can also check out the archive of over 40 episodes of Fractal Friends, which are now organized by category. I'm also excited to say that it is now possible for you to become a supporter of Fractal Friends. You can sign up to offer small or large contributions for each episode. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/fractalfriends, or you can click on the red button at fractalfriends.us. I am professionally dedicated to helping the world improve its capacity to communicate across our differences. I work with teams and companies, as well as organizations and groups, to help them transform their relationships with conflict and with each other. So if you know teams or groups that need support working together toward a common cause, please send them my way. I offer free initial discovery calls, and you can find my professional site at spokeandwheel.co. You can also learn more about me at duncanautry.com. Welcome to season 3 of Fractal Friends. This conversation was recorded in July of the year 2020. And now, please enjoy this conversation with Jeremy Lent. Jeremy, thank you so much for being on Fractal Friends. I am so excited to be connected with you and talking about all the things we're going to talk about today.
Well, thank you, Duncan. It's great to be here with you today. I'm looking forward to this.
So we were introduced by a mutual friend of ours, Annalise, who was a previous guest on Fractal Friends, wonderful elder and friend of mine. And we talked about racism and the importance of understanding our history there. And today we'll, of course, be getting into history as well. So anyways, grateful shout out to Annalise. Make sure that people check out that episode if they haven't had a chance. But I was really excited to be connected with you because I had been for a while, multiple people had told me to read The Patterning Instinct, because just when they hear me talk, they're like, you need to read this. And yeah, admittedly, I actually really started digging into it once I knew we were going to start talking. And you know, what I think is amazing about The Patterning Instinct is you're pulling together like so many different threads. It's a deep exploration of like human history and just the human mind, human culture. And, you know, it goes way back to our origins and then also does a deep exploration of our future. So, yeah, good job. It's really amazing. Yeah, but I want to know if you would just be willing to sort of introduce yourself, you know, like what you call yourself in this world, and tell us a little bit of how you describe the patterning instinct.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. So I call myself actually an author and integrator, because I realize that really everything I'm writing about and really how I live my life is all about integration. And hopefully that's like a theme that we can explore in some depth in this conversation. And the book, The Patterning Instinct itself, is very much a book of integration, because the subtitle of the book is a Cultural History of Humanity's Search for Meaning. That's essentially describes what it does all the way back from our earliest hunter-gatherer days as human beings to where we're going in the future and all this and some of the major steps in between. It looks at the ways the different cultures or cultural complexes have tried to like structure a sense of meaning into the universe and how that's affected history. And the reason it's called the patterning instinct is because it looks at the fact that as humans, something that seems to make us unique among other mammals is essentially all mammals have some instinct to pattern meaning into things, but we have it to a far greater degree, it seems. And that's the way in which an infant, for example, learns language when she first hears sounds and feels touches and stuff all around her, because she's driven by her instinct to pattern meaning into what she sees around us. And humans have done the same. And so the book explores the ways in which that's happened through history. And the reason I call it a work of integration is it's not just a history book, and it's not just a philosophy book, and it's not just an anthropology book. It looks at interweaving many of the disciplines that in the West we sort of have separate, but to really give a sense of like a broader, and in some way to say a deeper exploration of where meaning might lie according to different perspectives through history and to the present. And the reason I feel it's not just an exploration of theory about history, and it's not even just about our own way of like understanding meaning, but one of the key themes of the book is that the values a culture creates actually shapes history, actually shapes what they do. And those values shape history. And that's why, by the same token, values that we as a global society come up with based on our own sense of meaning right now are what's going to shape the future.
Yeah. Well, so, gosh, thank you again. And want to like really just put a shout out to this concept of integration. You talked about it as like this weaving of different patterns or different threads. And something I also appreciate about you is that you also really recognize the importance of like personal integration. It's one thing for us to understand all these things, but then it's another thing to like actually embody it and bring it into our actual life. And one of the things I'm always interested in is that tension between like the individual and culture, you know, that, you know, like culture is this collective experience, but then, you know, the individual is kind of creating culture and then the culture is creating the individual. So we want to actually start by like unpacking some definitions here. One of them will be culture and just sort of what you understand about that. But also I just want to start with actually, let's talk about meaning and not necessarily what is the meaning of life, but what is meaning? why do we care? You know, why does this seem to be a thread that goes through all of your work? Like, how do you understand this like search for meaning?
Yeah. Well, let me start off just with a little bit of a personal account of that, because really the reason I got so interested in meaning, and that became really sort of central to all my work, is I found myself in the middle of my life. I guess I went through a real crisis about 15 or so years ago, where I'd built my life in one direction, where I'd actually started an internet company. And I was in business and I took the company public. And by all external accounts, I looked very successful. And then everything kind of collapsed around me in terms of the things I'd built up. My wife at the time, she passed away some years back. She began to develop the symptoms of the illness that ended up causing her death. And I left the company at a very early stage to look after her. Even I had just taken the company public. Then I had to really focus my attention on looking after her. The company then collapsed. My wife at the time suffered cognitive decline. So even though I spent years looking after her, I lost the person I was really close to. And I really formed this question in my life. I made a kind of commitment to myself that I was going to, wherever I did next in my life, was going to be something that felt truly meaningful to me. But then this question arose, like, what is meaning? And I felt that I had built the first part of my life on structures and pathways that were not meaningful. And I wanted to make sure that I did that going forward. So I started this search for meaning, essentially, which is why that subtitle of the book, A Cultural History of Humanity's Search for Meaning, is not just coincidence or just a theoretical nicety. For me, it was like, what are these ideas that we're told about the soul, or about concepts about humans being unique versus the rest of the world, or what is it that humans are meant to do, or what does it mean to have a life of true meaning? These are the questions I was asking. So meaning became a very important part of everything I was doing. And I ended up actually coming up with my own definition, if you will, of meaning. Sometimes I ask people to just sort of think for a moment about what is meaningful to them. What are their moments in life which truly felt meaningful? And then other times in life when things felt meaningless. And in my experience, what meaning has to do with is very much to do with connectivity. It's essentially, in a way, you can almost define meaning as being something that emerges as a function of connectedness. So when things are meaningful, it's because they connect with many different aspects of life. It could be as meaningful because they connect deeply with people around you, or with all of humanity, or with a sense of connecting with all of life. That's when things feel meaningful. And when people feel meaningless, and to the extreme, you know, where people even feel like in places of deep depression or even suicidal, it's almost always a sense of being isolated, that things don't connect up, that they feel isolated themselves, that some things that happen in their life don't feel meaningful because they don't feel connected with other things that seem more important. So I very much think that meaning and connectedness go very closely together.
Well, I really appreciate that. Something that I focus on a lot or think about a lot is this tension between the self and the other. And we're individuals and we're in a collective. Paul Tillich talked about power as a drive for every individual to, you know, express itself with more intensity. And then love is the desire to reconnect with the separated. And that these are like these two fundamental drives that are like an interdependent system. And it's interesting because they're like, it's like connectivity, but it's like connectivity plus meaning, because like there's a thing about like individual meaning. Anyways, they're fascinating how they're kind of hard to talk about even at the same time. So anyways, I really appreciate that framing of meaning. And of course, this is something that's really important to us across time. You know, it's like our society is like basically just like how the self understands itself in relation to others. You know, so I appreciate that a lot. And of course, that like opens up to some of these other things I wanted to sort of lay it down as a foundation. I know you talk about this being a cognitive history, and I know that you're sort of influenced by this like Santiago theory of cognition, which has to do with like a systems approach, right? That we're basically, it's like the interconnectedness of, could you try to actually explain that a little bit? Yeah.
You know, we're definitely going to some of the deeper deeper places here. Yeah, for people who don't know that name, the Santiago theory of cognition essentially was something devised a few decades ago by two brilliant South American biologists, Maturana and Varela. And they came up with what's known as a word they coined it, or at least they popularized it. And the word is autopoiesis, which itself is a bit of an intimidating word. And what autopoiesis really means, it comes from the Greek to essentially create yourself or to create oneself. And they actually came up with a theory of life, trying to understand what life is from the perspective of theories of self-organization and systems thinking. And what they saw as defining life as separate from everything else that is non-living on the earth and everywhere in the universe is that life is essentially a process. It's not so much a thing, it's a process of self-creation. And some entity could be as small as a cell or as large as a whale or as complex as a human being, but some entity is self-organized and has some kind of membrane that separates it from the rest of the world. And what it does is it takes in matter and energy from outside, and it self-creates it through metabolism to give it the energy and the organization it needs to regenerate itself, to continually regenerate itself for the purpose ultimately of staying alive, of creating more life. So there's something about this process of life that also leads to a sense of a sort of deep purpose. And so you might sort of wonder, well, what's that got to do with cognition? And really they sort of took this notion of, oftentimes the word cognition we might think of in terms of like knowing. It's like some form of knowing, something to do with how you know something. And their concept was that any living entity is a cognitive entity. It knows the difference between itself inside and what is outside. And that is the form of ultimately what sort of life is about. And that's why it's called the theory of cognition. So it's like everything comes from that core knowledge, which some you can also think of in terms of like sentience. I really like that word sentience because it's a sense of feeling the difference between yourself and other. And it's both the separation and the connection. Because like if you think of what a membrane is ultimately, it's actually quite a complex, very profound idea, because a membrane is something that separates the inside from the outside, which is necessary in order to process all the stuff that's out there to regenerate yourself. But it's also something that allows for the transmission. So to put out what isn't good for you anymore into the rest of the world and to take in what you need to keep growing and keep being alive. So a membrane is quite complex. It's this notion of it's the ways in which you connect with the rest of the world and the ways in which you can maintain a sense of separation too.
Mm-hmm. I'm part of an organization called Mediators Beyond Borders. And it was initially called Without Borders. And then there's a little bit of a story there. But upon settling on the idea of Beyond Borders, it made a lot more sense because the border is a very powerful thing. It's not, as you said, like the membrane, it's not just the point of division and separation. It's also the point of meeting and interaction. It's the interface, you know, between the self and other. And I really appreciate this because what this theory of cognition starts doing, it's really helping bridge that line between what we think of as hard reality and what people might think of as being more spiritual concepts, just in the sense that it's bringing an explanation to something that seems very mysterious. You know, like life, of course, is like one of, you know, life's one of the great mysteries, you know, but this idea that it's a process is a very interesting way of sort of getting us out of that dilemma. It's not a thing that exists or a thing that doesn't exist. It's a process that is being born out of the interaction of a bunch of stuff. And process, whether process exists or not, is kind of, we don't have to really get into that, but you know, but that's like a, because we can imagine it and we can experience it. And so I just really appreciate that idea of like life and cognition, just even the mental capacity. It's just like, it's a process. And then it's a really great solution to like a really old problem.
And, you know, just to follow on from that, that same approach works incredibly powerfully to another of these great concepts that people have debated for centuries, is the notion of mind. Because often people say, well, what is mind? And can mind exist separate from the body? And what is the split between mind and body? And all these things. And again, once we think in terms of process, we can recognize mind itself is an emergent process of the massively complex interaction between the whole sort of neurobiology of an organism. And so mind, just like life, is something that's not a thing, but is something that is continually self-organizing and regenerating itself and actually creating itself from one moment to the next.
Yeah, what kind of this allows us to do is then make this jump, you know, because we also think about like culture is like not exactly a thing, but it's something that is regenerated across generations and influences things, creates artifacts. Those artifacts then, you know, create culture and so forth. But it's nice to understand things that are not things. And I think that this points to what is this tension between like the reductionist like approach to science and the systems approach to science. And first, I just like always love pointing out that like science is a methodology. It's not, you know, like I see signs sometimes that say science is real. And it's like, no, it's not real. It's just a, again, like a methodology to sort of test things, confirm them, figure out if we can come up with predictable outcomes and things. And so it's just a way of explaining things. But there's this big tension in this world between like a reductionist approach and this like systems approach. And that seems to be something that we're getting stuck on, figuring out how to hold both of those. And I was wondering if you would be willing to unpack a little bit what I just said.
Yeah, and I'm so glad you make that distinction between science and reductionism. And that's actually something I've been writing. I write a lot about, both in The Patterning Instinct and in the new book that is coming out next year called The Web of Meaning, which actually the subtitle of it is Integrating Science and Traditional Wisdom to Find Our Place in the Universe. So it relates a lot to this conversation. And in that this new book, I go into quite a lot of detail on this question you just raised about reductionism and systems thinking. And so much of the time we notice among people who may be listening to this conversation or just people we know, the sense that there's this distinction between science and spirituality. And sometimes, you know, you might see people really focusing on, I don't believe anything unless I can see it scientifically proven. And that seems to be this dichotomy with something that's truly spiritual. And as I unpack this, what we see is pretty much exactly what you were just pointing out. The distinction is not between science and a spiritual understanding, but between reductionism and a spiritual understanding of life. Because basically, let's first think what science is. To your point, science is really a methodology. It's really one of the great breakthroughs in all of human history that we've achieved. And something that is this great sort of gift to humanity. It's this notion of really trying to understand what is going on around us in a way that is transparent and in a way that is always open to questions and ways where we can come up with theories and then test those theories and then have other people critique it. And so it's this wonderful process of really being open to questioning and understanding further and always being curious. That's what science basically is. Reductionism is a particular means of taking science and applying science that got developed along with the scientific revolution in Europe in the 17th century. And it got developed by people like Descartes and Francis Bacon and Galileo and others. And what reductionism says is basically like we can understand things better if we break them down to their component parts. And there's a lot of truth to that. And in fact, reductionism has been incredibly powerful as a tool to understand the nature of reality. And it led to things like, as people reduce things further, they got to say, oh, well, one branch of this reducing things should be called chemistry, and one branch is physics, and one branch is biology. And then in each of those areas, they went deeper and deeper to find what they were, the sort of building blocks of reality. It might be in terms of chemistry, it's like maybe molecules and electrons. In terms of physics, it goes into like even things below the atom. And then in biology, they look at things like the gene as these kind of building blocks or amino acids or whatever they might be. And because these sciences have been so powerful in transforming the world, many reductionists through the ages, through the centuries, have gotten to be so taken by the success of their enterprise that they then felt that that was the true description of reality. So they made what I call an ontological leap to say, well, this is working so well to understand things that all of reality must be based on this. And then it becomes, from going to being a scientific methodology, becomes a leap of faith. Really, every bit as much of a leap of faith as believing in God or believing in any kind of creed, which is to say that this is must be true. And therefore, anybody who tries to look at reality in some way that doesn't reduce it to its component parts is not valid. That's not the truth. The only truth is available through breaking things down. But what reductionism misses is that without denying the validity of the reductionist methodology, our reality is also about the ways in which those tiny little building blocks of things interconnect with each other. And systems thinking and complexity science and these different ways of looking at things look at the actual ways in which things actually connect. And like just we were talking about life, like life itself can be understood as the ways in which different elements connect with each other in complex, self-organized, regenerative ways. And reductionism alone is unable to understand and make sense of all the amazing complexity that arises from the ways in which things interconnect. So a true understanding of science has to accept reductionism as a certain base and then go beyond reductionism to this notion of looking at sciences of connectivity. And the reason why I get so excited about this is that when we try to understand things from a more spiritual dimension, what we see is that just like we were talking before about meaning being a function of connectivity, we can to that in the same sort of way look at spirituality itself as being really an emphasis or a focus on the connection between things. So that when we begin to look at that, we begin to see that a more systems-oriented approach to science begins to merge with a meaning approach to spirituality. And we begin to see that science and meaning, or science and spirituality, are not actually opposed or dichotomous at all, but actually just different lenses of looking at the same underlying reality of the universe and of our lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is really good. And I feel really grateful to recognize that, like, that the tension's not between religion and science, or spirituality and science, but between reductionism and that reductionism gets tons of props because it was really helped us break the world down. But of course, then what happened is, you know, people start understanding we have like physics, we're breaking down the, you know, atoms and figuring out that, and we're looking at chemistry and we're looking at biology and all these different things we're breaking down and just trying to figure out taxonomy and evolution, and just everyone's trying to reduce things down to their units. And then there was this thing that started happening where across all of these different systems or all these different directions of study, they were starting to notice that there was something in the interdependence that was significant, that there's something about a bunch of units working together that create something that's bigger. And that started creating this like a systemics approach. And so you go from like studying an animal to then studying ecology, or you're going from studying biology to studying, you know, these interactive things. And so understanding that these things were complex systems was a huge leap. And it took until relatively recently that all these different people in different fields, from sociology to biology to ecology and beyond, and physics and mathematics, were able to come together and start recognizing that we're looking at as systems, that these are all complex systems. And so that has created this like kind of transdisciplinary field. And I'm going to put a big shout out to Benoit Mandelbrot, who was the person who named fractals. And he was one of the people that was really key in noticing this, that there was something happening when things are just very, even these like crazy, wild, complex things that seem impossible to wrap our minds around, the fact that there are underlying patterns within all of them actually can be explained relatively easily, but just not by reducing them. And what I think is really interesting, and I love this part in your book where you talk about how Lorenz in 1972 pointed out that, you know, this like that we can have deterministic reality where things are happening and very following rules, following laws of, you know, science or math, but yet they can still be chaotic, that kind of pointing out to that. And that this was a huge breakthrough. And they were saying that, like, wow, we haven't understood this kind of stuff since Isaac Newton, but these things already existed for thousands of years, but they've been hidden in Taoism and indigenous belief systems, right? Like you could read Lao Tzu and find explanations of how there's patterns in nature, but it just wasn't in science yet.
That is so true. And that's what gets me so excited oftentimes is again, when we're looking at these connections between things, is realizing that what modern systems thinking and systems science leads us to is an understanding of the world that is very consistent with what both indigenous wisdom and especially traditional Chinese thought also saw about how the world works. And also, I should add, in Buddhist thought, we see similar things too. And just to go back to your thing you were mentioning there about Edward Lorenz, it's a great story for people who don't know it. He was actually a meteorologist back in the 1960s, back in the days when most people were thinking of, with the advent of computers, that there was really like sort of no dimension that was not going to be subject to understanding in a determinist way using all this new computing power. And he was actually trying to come up with predicting weather systems weeks in advance through using sort of powerful computing methodology. And he set up this experiment using his computer, and he had a certain response. And then he tried to repeat it a few days later, and he thought he had exactly the same set of inputs. And he went to have some coffee, came back, and discovered his outputs were completely different from what they were last time. So he thought, oh, I must have made some mistake. So he went back and checked, everything was the same. And then as he researched, he discovered that the only difference between the two was one variable he had given to like the third decimal place the first one time, and one variable he gave to like the six decimal places the second time. And that one tiny little shift led to a completely different outcome. So he was the one who then came up with this notion of chaos theory. He was the one who asked this question, is it possible that the flap of a butterfly's wings in Brazil could cause a tornado in Texas? And this realization was that things like weather and any complex self-organized system, which includes human beings or human culture, by nature, not deterministic. You can never actually plan, know exactly where something's going to go. Even if you knew every single data point in that system, the way in which they relate to each other in such complex ways is so nonlinear that there's no way you can actually plan it out or forecast it in detail more than just a very few steps ahead.
Well, sorry, I just wanted to make sure, just like really clarify this. It's not saying that things are just random. They still follow rules and laws of nature, but it's just, it's so complex and so detailed that it becomes unpredictable. Like it just the tiniest little change can influence everything.
Thank you. That's really a great point. Then that leads to this important distinction that in the world, in sort of the Newtonian world, or this notion of a fixed deterministic world, you know, laws, you have like Newton's laws or whatever. And in the Newtonian world, which works in something like outer space, because there's very little random noise to sort of stop things doing exactly as you might predict. And so you could actually predict almost to the, you know, tiniest infinitesimal amount what something's going to be doing in the future. That's why you can predict so many things about astronomy, maybe thousands or even millions of years into the future. But then when you look at the complex world of the real world of life that we live in every day, if you can't actually have deterministic laws, what you can come up with, and this is what scientists have begun to do, is principles of organization. There are certain principles according to the way things work, which can apply in lots of different areas. And they may not allow you to determine exactly what's going to happen, but they can give you a sense of how things will happen. And to your point, Duncan, fractals is one of those principles, which is that when things self-organize, they create patterns that then tend to express themselves at different magnitudes, not exactly the same pattern, but similarity of patterns. So they're recognizably similar at different levels of magnitude, all the way from the tiniest to the largest. And that's really what a notion of a fractal is. And in fact, fractals are a great way of, when you're looking at some system, you see it fractal, you can figure it's almost certainly self-organized in some way. What's so fascinating is that when you look at those principles of organization, that is something that then leads us to looking at how other traditional ways of looking at the universe, non-Western ways, overlap with that. Because, for example, in traditional China, there was this school of thinkers called the Neo-Confucianists who came up with a similar way of looking at life and saying that basically all of the universe was comprised of what they called qi, which we can translate as being sort of energy and matter, like all the sort of the stuff of the universe. And the word they came up with was li, which described the way in which the qi organizes itself to become manifested in the universe. So to their way of looking at things, all of the universe was both qi and li, the stuff and the ways in which that stuff actually interacts and organizes in order to be what we see, what we're part of in the world. And so that concept of li, that sort of really is often translated as principle of self-organization, is almost exactly the same concept as what systems scientists are developing when they look at how the reductionist world self-organizes to create the complex reality we live in.
As we're just like maybe diving into this like Eastern-Western split slash potential integration point here, and you know, in systems kind of being this like wonderful intersection of these, it's like pointing out that we have this idea of a linear reductionist approach to things, and then on the other hand, coming from the East or from the traditional things or from a systems approach, we can find this cyclical, kind of nonlinear, interdependent kind of approach to understanding things. And that there's like really interesting implications in science, but there's also really interesting ethical implications of this. And I think that actually Fritjof Capra really gets into that as well. But what do you see, like what happens when we start culturally understanding the world from this more cyclical, nonlinear, interdependent, while still holding on to that reductionist, individualistic understanding too, you know?
Yes, I love that you bring in the ethical and moral implications of that, because once you start recognizing that everything is actually interdependent, you begin to look at your own role in the world in a very different way. We're told by our Western way of thinking that we are sort of separate individuals in the world. And just like atoms, we're told, like exist as these sort of irreducible parts or genes. The selfish genes are these irreducible elements of life that make life how it evolves. These are really, it turns out, are myths of reductionist thinking. And another myth of reductionist thinking is that as individuals, we are separate, both morally, ethically, or in any other way from the rest of the world. Once we look at how society works from an interdependent point of view, we realize that everything we do, whether we are conscious of it or not, actually is the result of so much that's happened in history, so much is happening in the world right now, and has implications for what is going to happen in the world right now and to others all around us. And that is a huge differential. And that's also, by the way, an incredibly important point of intersection between systems thinking and some elements of Buddhist thought. There's this core Buddhist concept, which is translated sometimes as dependent co-arising of things. And it's this kind of concept that nothing exists by itself, but only is this sort of transient experience, phenomenon of interactivity from all of the stuff that's happened in the past and interacts with things to create a future that's also shifting and changing. And this great Buddhist teacher, philosopher Thich Nhat Hanh, who has developed this into this concept he calls interbeing, which I think is such a powerful concept. His notion is, even anything, he'll hold up a piece of paper. So you think you're looking at this piece of paper, what you're really looking at is the whole universe. You're looking at the sun, you're looking at the weather, you're looking at people around you, you're looking at all of life. And that's because, of course, that paper is the result of all those things, of the sun and creating life on Earth, of trees, taking the sun's energy of humans, taking, you know, cutting down the trees and turning it into the paper. And way to look at that is it's not just, and that's a beautiful sort of looking at the sense of the interbeing of cosmology, but there's also a political and a moral way of looking at that same interbeing. When you hold out that piece of paper, you realize what you're looking at is also the destruction of rainforests as modern civilization sort of turns something into some sort of monocropped forest in order to create the plantations to get the paper. And you may be looking at the virtual slave labor of people in the global south who then take that wood pulp and turn it into this paper and this kind of the globalization that allows you to buy a ream of paper at an incredibly cheap price at like Staples or Office Depot or whatever. And that globalization, all the impacts of that on climate breakdown. And so that piece of paper also has in it, like almost like a fractal connectivity with the ways in which we are embedded. And that piece of paper and us holding it are embedded in the processes that are actually partly causing so much of the suffering of other human beings in the world right now, and some of the incredible destruction of the whole sort of global ecological and climate system through our sort of rampant, out of control global economic system that's going on. So it's amazing once you start to think about interdependence and interbeing, the implications are massive in their magnitude.
Oh, man. Yeah, it's really amazing to, you know, to really sit with that, to really sit with the way that, you know, all the pieces are connected in like these really profound ways. You know, you can start anywhere and go everywhere. And part of that is that we can, once we start understanding our interdependence, then we can also start understanding like what is the impact of all the choices that we make. Like even the small choices are, you know, we are like the butterflies flapping the wings, you know, it's every little action is rippling out. You also mentioned like the selfish gene, and it makes me think about, there's a book, I think it's called Does Altruism Exist? And there's this idea that, especially when you're taking that reductionist approach, and definitely that, you know, with evolution, like every little individual is competing against the other individuals for their own success. And, you know, and but somehow it seems like people do good for the sake of others, but they don't, there's not really any reason why anyone would want to do that if we're all just being selfish. It doesn't, you know, if it's all just individuals fighting for individuals, doing something for the good of others, sacrificing for the good of others doesn't make any sense. But what he found is, and this is actually the Darwin even talked about this as well, that groups, the group that is caring for itself as a group, will succeed in the face of other groups where people are being selfish. So if you have a group of people who are selfish in it and a group of people that are being altruistic for their group, the group that is looking out for others in the group will survive, while the group that has a bunch of people that don't care about the group will fall apart. And one of the conclusions that this author gets to, and I'll make sure that this gets into the show notes, is that we need to like start understanding that our group is Earth. And that if we can understand I'm on team humanity or team planet Earth and be in a way selfish for Earth, like that's a way that we could get that up level, that selfish gene thing is like, you know, like I'm part of this living system and I'm going to really defend the heck out of this living system. Hi, Fractal friends. Sorry for the interruption. I'll keep this one quick. So are you part of a team or a group or an organization? I bet that you are. Actually, I bet that you're part of a few of them. Whatever your purpose is, I know that for you to be successful, you need to be able to count on the web of relationships that hold you together as you work towards your mission. It's hard sometimes to find a balance between being effective, acting decisively, and getting things done on one hand, while also cultivating a safe, caring, joyful, and collaborative environment on the other. But it is vitally important that your group both strikes and sustains that balance between people and purpose. So how's your team doing? Are you getting along? How are you adapting to the changing context that we're all in? Is your team struggling to work together to achieve its life-affirming purpose? If so, I would love to talk to you. In my company, Spoke and Wheel, we call ourselves the Workplace Relationship Experts, and we believe that great relationships are what drive great organizations. Whether you're part of a big company or a small startup or something in between, we've got you covered. or maybe you're part of a group or organization that's working for political and social change. We've got that covered too, through our partnership with Mediators Beyond Borders International. And as a bonus, we are designed to work with remote teams in a 100% virtual environment. So wherever you are, whatever you're doing, if you are ready to transform your relationships and get your crew to be happily moving in the same direction again, we're here for you. Come on over to spokeandwheel.co and schedule a free call with us. Again, that is spokeandwheel.co. And now, back to the show. And that's it's kind of something you can do with that interdependence, just like the cells in my body are all trying to make sure that I stay alive. We as humans, as being the cells of humanity, can also be making sure that humanity survives. Because this is actually a real question at this point.
Well said. And the author, by the way, is David Sloan Wilson, of that book, Does Altruism Exist? I love the way that the book, the title is his question, and the whole book is the answer, is this resounding yes. Yeah, I think this is super important. And you know, we talked about how there's this self-esteem myth, which was sort of propagated by Richard Dawkins. And it's been shown by many different ways over the last few decades by leading theorists and biologists in various subdisciplines of biology to be totally just an untrue. It's untrue on two counts. One is that, you know, one of the myths is that the gene is this ultimate building block of life that directs everything else. And so cells and organisms and everything are really just the sort of frameworks in which genes replicate themselves. Well, that's untrue. And the second way in which it's untrue is this notion that it's selfishness actually is the driving force of how evolution works. So just to unpack that a little bit, the reason why it's actually untrue that the gene is the ultimate building block is in modern decades of biology, people have recognized what is called this notion of epigenetics, which is that actually there's a lot more to inheritance from one organism to the next than simply passing on the gene. And the ways in which cells actually work is not that the gene tells them what to do, but there's this interaction. It's a little bit like a conversation that goes on between the gene within the cell and the actual rest of the cell. And the cell, in fact, has different proteins that go and interact with the gene and tell the gene what parts of it should be expressed in order to change the way the cell works. So the whole thing is an interactive process once again, which gets to this point between this difference between the reductionist and the more systems understanding of life. And in fact, when we look at how evolution worked all the way from the beginning of life, billions of years ago to now, the major stages of evolution, like when cells went from being what are called prokaryotes to having a nucleus in them, which makes them called eukaryotes, and when organisms became multicellular, and then when those organisms became parts of communities. In each of the great steps of life, which has led to this incredible profusion of life right now, each one came about when separate entities learned to cooperate together to actually create more complexity in themselves and in the world in a form of what's called symbiosis, where one entity and the other realizes that by working together, they can create something where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts. So what's interesting is that the actual driving force of evolution over billions of years has been this realization of further ways, higher levels of cooperation rather than selfishness, which I think is fascinating. It's a complete overturning of what is this sort of mainstream wrong idea about biology. And then when you get to humans, what's so exciting is that actually the same is true for humans. What makes humans unique among other primates is not that we became sort of more dominant in some way, but we learned to cooperate. When back in evolution, a few million years ago, when the sort of pre-human hominids got separated from the jungle and they found themselves in a more changeable climate, it was much more dangerous for them. And only the ones that learned to cooperate better were the ones that actually survived in those millions of years to ultimately produce modern humans. So to your point, you were saying originally, this notion of altruism, going beyond just biology to humans actually developed what are known as like moral emotions. So the things that matter, so that are so important to each of us, things like fairness, justice, we respect generosity in people, the sense of compassion, empathy, all of these are moral emotions that as humans, we evolved so that even before language came along, our sort of pre-human ancestors had these feelings to work together in groups. And that was what was important. And that's what made humans successful. And that's why, you know, now when we see these injustices taking place and we feel the sense of outrage, it's not our reason telling us, oh, there's something wrong according to some set of principles. It's our gut feeling telling us something's wrong, because that's how we evolved as humans. We evolved to want to be part of a bigger group and to be part of something where we feel things are fair and just.
Well, that inspires me to like dial into our present moment a little bit. We're talking in July of the year 2020, and we're in the middle of the global COVID-19 pandemic, as well as a time of cultural uprising around like a deep, long history of racial prejudice and injustice. And the background is divisive politics that's spreading in countries all over the world. And we're facing potential environmental collapse around climate change. And we're interconnected like we've never been before in history, which somehow is not necessarily getting us all to start cooperating more for some reason. The internet's not necessarily having that outcome. And, you know, potential artificial intelligence upgrade, downgrade, you know, technological takeover. It's a strange moment to be in. And I have kind of come to believe that, and this is why I'm so excited to be talking to you, that like our path forward really has to do with this capacity to integrate like ancient wisdom with modern knowledge. And somehow by connecting these pieces, that's part of the trick on how we get through this. We don't want to go backwards, and we don't want to go back to being hunter-gatherer, nomadic people living off the land like we were for the vast majority of our history. But we also cannot continue on the trajectory we're on. So it's a huge question here, but like, how does this integrating of all these different kinds of wisdom help us navigate this time that we're in?
Yeah, and I do think it can. And in fact, not just that it can, but it's essential. For us to move forward in the way that we need to. And let's explore some of these. I love the way you described the world, the state of the world as it is right now. What a beautiful and wide-ranging and accurate description, I think, of what's going on right now. And maybe we'll take a couple of points to what you're talking about and close in on them a little bit. And maybe the first is to look at this notion of the incredible racial injustice that the white people in the United States have begun to wake up to a little bit on account of the absolute traumatic outrage of the George Floyd killing and everything that came from that. And I think that's a great example of where we can look at how we can apply these lessons into being to understanding an implicit racism that often, you know, a white person until fairly recently might go around saying, oh yeah, I'm not a racist, while they might not be explicitly acting or saying something that is clearly objectively seen as racist, but they are enjoying the privilege that comes from being a white person in a racist society. And by enjoying that and by taking part in that, participating in that without using some of the power they have to actually change the incredible structures of injustice, that is essentially participating in a racist, white supremacist system, which, whether you like it or not, makes you a collaborator in that racism. And so that's one of these important ways. I mean, as somebody like, some people might have read this book by Ibram Ekendi called How to Be an Anti-Racist, I think is the name of it, where he describes that in just, you know, in great detail, with great clarity. And that's, again, a sense of, if you think of that piece of paper that Thich Nhat Hanh was holding up, this is what into being is about, is if you're a white person and you have been privileged to live a life where you're not having to think about racism, to understand that that doesn't give you a free pass, that you are interconnected. Your privilege is interconnected with the history of the people who were actually oppressed and who are currently oppressed right now, both in the United States and in the rest of the world, especially in the global South. And so by taking advantage of those of that privilege, without exploring what are the implications, and without taking some of your own power and privilege to try to shift those underlying structures, you have to realize, and all of us to some extent are part of that oppressive structure. And even if, you know, we're working to undo some of those oppressions, it's still important to recognize how much we continue to benefit from them, even while we're trying to shift some of those structural elements. And that's, I think, one really important way in which this concept of interconnectivity can help to move us towards the better world that we need.
Right. Like really thinking about systemic racism as a system, that we actually are understanding that just like ecosystems, a system, like that racism and even dominance culture is a system.
Exactly. And then, you know, similarly, the thing, same applies to really the greatest existential crisis of our age, the overwhelming one, which is that at the rate in which our civilization is continuing to consume the earth at a faster and faster pace, we may well be headed for the very end of our civilization, just accelerating towards a precipice. And the climate breakdown is only the most obvious extreme example of that. But even if that was somehow magically solved, which is not going to be at the current rate unless things shift dramatically and structurally, the whole ecological breakdown is completely unsustainable and incompatible with a continued long-term civilization of any kind of way that we would want to see one. Everything from the destruction of the fish in the ocean, the deforestation, the desertification, the sixth great extinction of species. Everywhere we look, the living earth is being destroyed by the continued growth of this global economy that we're all part of. So that's something where, once again, we need to recognize that the actions each of us take and the inactions that each of us allow to happen are all part of this unfolding catastrophe that we're moving towards.
You know, one of the things that really struck me kind of towards the end of your book, The Patterning Instinct, is that if civilization collapses, you know, this round, there might not be enough of abundance on the planet for whoever's left to give it another go. Like, this is it, people. Like, this is our move. And I also just want to like kind of lift out this thing about action and inaction, our choices. And that was something, that's a great lesson that I learned through Taoism, you know, is like act, don't act, like there is no in between. Actually, that's Yoda. Actually, my bad. Do or do not. There is no try. Right. Yeah.
One of the great Taoists of all history is Yoda. Yeah. Huh?
Actually, that's really interesting. I just was reminded, got in touch with an old friend from college, that he was the one who got me into Taoism by pointing out that the Force, you know, from Star Wars is based on Taoism. But so this is like a thought that's kind of came together as I was researching these things. And I was actually like, both of us have an affinity for Alan Watts. And so I pulled out my Alan Watts books and I was reading about Taoism and the Watercourse Way, which I know is an influential book for you too. And, you know, he's talking about, you know, the yin yang polarity in Taoism, and he's talking about Chinese culture. And there was just like this line here that I can pull out. It's page 32. If there's anything basic in Chinese culture, it's an attitude of respectful trust towards nature and human nature. Despite wars, revolutions, mass extinction, starvation, floods, droughts, and all manner of horrors, there's nothing in their philosophy like the notion of original sin. And it's interesting to notice that trusting that the flow is going to work out, you know, like there's like a bigger picture thing going on here and we can trust that. And just like there's that wisdom in that, and just even recognizing that that's kind of, you know, obviously very old, but still there. And then I was having a conversation with someone just in this last week also about the collapse of civilization and then distinct from the collapse of empire, right? So we have the United States empire, which is also teetering on a precipice of potential falling apart. We're just not able to like make even effective decisions. You know, right now, I think I just saw that we have more COVID cases, you know, than the whole rest of the world. And, you know, of course, we're also creating more pollution than the whole rest of the world. And, you know, we're not, you know, anywhere near even a quarter of the population. And we're in a tricky moment here. And so when someone said, well, the U.S. empire, you know, it's probably going to be the China that'll be the ones, the next empire. And it's like, well, if civilization doesn't collapse first, because if civilization goes down, it's a whole global breakdown, right? But then I was like, huh, that's interesting. Is there a possibility that because Chinese culture has kind of already kind of naturally done the integration of like Western and Eastern, do they have the potential to pull this off? And then I'm like, I don't know. Anyways, this is a kind of this burgeoning little thought here that like maybe the Chinese empire future is potentially primed, you know, for being the ones who can like integrate, you know, this. I'm not sure if that's true. I need to go talk to more Chinese scholars right now, but it's interesting, like thought that was bubbling up in my head.
It's an interesting thought. And something I've looked at a fair amount, especially so much of my writing has to do with traditional Chinese thought. And, you know, what initially at first at least seems to bolster that even more is there's this powerful idea that I get excited by is called an ecological civilization. The notion of a civilization being built rather than on wealth accumulation like this current one, on the principles of life, a life-affirming civilization. And here's China, actually, over the last 10 years or so, they've actually talked about that as one of their basic principles of their future. The government's plan is to build an ecological civilization. And they talk about that and it sounds great. But then when you look just even a little bit at China the way it is right now, it's actually one of the most terrifying authoritarian regimes, really, not just currently in the world, but all through history. I mean, they're essentially, they have something called the Road and Belt Initiative, I think, something like that. It's this massive initiative of growth to sort of establish their economic dominance through most of Eurasia and Africa. And it is massively destroying many of the ecosystems of that whole area. And the growth of Chinese economy has been one of the major factors in the increased ecological degradation we're seeing all around the world. So from an ecological point of view, while they may be saying one thing, they're actually doing something very different. And then even more terrifying is that they're using all of the powers of the internet to create the most extreme surveillance state ever in history, as something that even George Orwell's 1984 kind of pales into significance. To what they're accomplishing right now in this really terrifying totalitarian move. So even though I would love to believe in this notion that somehow the Chinese will get in touch with their traditional wisdom, which has been so inspirational and one of the greatest gifts to all of humanity, we have to recognize that what we're seeing right now in China is the beginnings of a force and power that really may be even more terrifying than what we see in the United States, which itself is incredibly destructive and dangerous. So just don't want to put out any kind of false hopes there in terms of, unless we see something very significant change in China in their authoritarian approach, I think we need to be very wary of looking in that direction.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate that. And this idea was like a little bit kind of like tongue in cheek, but it was something I wanted to explore with you because it's because there's something interesting here. So then like, I mean, yeah, that surveillance state stuff, it's like the what they're doing with the Uyghurs is, I mean, it's so scary. It is science fiction level scary. And I'll definitely make sure there's like resources about this. This is going to be one of the most resource heavy episode pages for sure. So people go to fractalfriends.us and find all the resources that this conversations is prompting. But following its current course, China is not going to take us there. Following its current course, the United States isn't going to take us there, right? Russia is not going to take us there. Brazil, I just had a hope for Brazil for a while, but they're not going to be the ones that get us there. And okay, so here we are. It's us. We're kind of this collective space. There's definitely part of that's happening here in this year 2020 is like there's a massive cultural upgrade. I mean, like there's the level of awareness of systemic issues that is massive. And so maybe like there's I can just pull this into like the question that I kind of like asking all the guests that are on the show is like, okay, so given all these different pieces here, what is something you would invite the people who are listening to this episode to pay attention to or think about as we're trying to make a better life for ourselves and for the world? What direction do we point ourselves?
Yes, I do think in order to answer that most fully, let me just kind of riff a little bit about where you were going in what, again, I think was a very wise and true description of what's going on in the world, all these different forces we see that are not going to get us where we need to go. And the implication is, well, what is, you know, do we, are we left with kind of a sense of hopelessness? Where can we turn? And I think that what is so, so critical is to realize that there is a force that's more powerful than any of those you mentioned, which is basically the force of our shared humanity and the force of billions of human beings who at their core, at their heart, want to be part of a thriving, flourishing, healthy earth, want to be part of a healthy society. Actually, you know, we as humans want happiness. We want love. We want connection. We want health all around us. And basically, the reason that's not been happening is because we are in a society which essentially brainwashes people to then learn to look for materialist values and sort of get on what's known as the hedonic treadmill in order to just thinking that that's the only thing that's left, because that's what's bombarded into our brains from infancy onwards with advertising and internet and all the different sort of pictures promoting this kind of affluent lifestyle, et cetera. And so that leads to come back to your question, I think what each of us can do, and this is the big invitation to each of us, is to look into what's really meaningful to us. Look into what actually really matters to me. What do I really care about? And then once you sort of begin to touch into that in your own life, begin to touch into how that connects you with what other people also care about. Even people who might seem like they're on opposite sides.
The key thing is, because it's fractal in nature, our day-to-day interactions are reflective of, you know, are self-similar to the global interactions. And the quality that we bring to those, the global experience is just, well, it's only 7.5 billion people interacting on an interpersonal level. But so I'm actually somehow really glad that this was like something I just had thought that I had this morning. It's like a kind of in that liminal dream space. I'm glad to remember it right now. In conflict resolution, we talk about shifting from a posture which is like face to face. We're like, you're my problem and I'm facing off with you, right? And so like we are against each other. We're fighting you and you're my problem, right? And then what happens is we like start to resolve a conflict or transform it is to get us into a posture where you and I are standing side by side, shoulder to shoulder, looking at the problem and realizing that we're together needing to do this, right? And so the problem then becomes this third entity. And I was just having this vision of just like, collectively, whether it's like on the left or the right or, you know, populist or spiritual science, that we all get to stand shoulder to shoulder and we're all looking at the same problem as opposed to looking at each other as though they are the problems. And then it's the idea that like others want to feel secure too is like really powerful. I recently got to have the experience, opportunity of going with a friend of mine, kind of going down like a really deep conspiracy rabbit hole, right? I was right wing, QAnon, like Trump is part of a secret military plot that's going to like overthrow the satanic pedophile cabal that's controlling the government behind the scenes. You know, I'm like, oh my, you know, really went down that rabbit hole with this person. It was so interesting. We got to the end of this long video, and the person was like, and then there will be peace in the world because we have uprooted the evil leadership that is messing things up. And I was like, wait a minute, are you telling me at the very bottom of the right-wing conspiracy of the, you know, is a desire for world peace? Hold on a second. And making sure that corporations aren't controlling us anymore. I know people on the left that are super far down the left in his own rabbit hole that are also looking at the same things. Like, how do we overthrow the corporation? This looks like some ultra-progressive approach as well. And it's like, wait a minute, everyone wants peace? What are we doing here? What is happening? There was another podcast where we almost kind of got to this. I mean, it was like a joke, but it was really beautiful. Wait a minute. Like, what if you were just building the world that you want to live in? That was like the most beautiful world that you could imagine. And I'm working on creating the world, best world that I can imagine. Well, if everyone was doing that, we would live in the most beautiful world that all of us could imagine. It's like a really simple solution, people. just go make it better. Like, what is meaningful to you? What do you care about? Lift that up.
Right. I hear you. And I do think that an important element on that has to do with a sense of where your identity lies. Because we are, again, we're told by our dominant culture that our entity is as individuals. And if you consider yourself purely as an individual, then it's logical to say, well, I want as much money and power as possible because then it's better for me. I can do what I want. And then oftentimes that gets expanded to your family. So, yeah, I want my family to be as successful as possible, et cetera. But then as those layers of identity expand, it becomes, rather than this zero-sum game of everybody fighting each other, it becomes everybody working together for something that's in benefit of all. So if you start to identify more with your community, then that's a big improvement. But even then, there's the in-group and out-group. And it's like, don't let the immigrants into our community. And so that also leads to these separations. But then if you expand that identity further to include all of humanity, that is a huge shift in where values arise and where different priorities arise. And even then, that can lead to the destruction of the living earth, unless you expand identity all the way to all of life, which is what you talked about at the very beginning of this conversation. And I think that's what's crucial for us to really forge a path for true sustainable flourishing on this earth, is to really feel into that identity that I am life. There's this great quote from the humanitarian Albert Schweitzer, the Nobel Prize winner from the 20th century. One of his great quotes was, I am life that wills to live in the midst of life that wills to live. And what a great way of realizing that what we all of us want is the same thing, this desire for more life, for more flourishing. And once we can truly integrate that and truly absorb that, then I think what you say is true, that then if we all work together to build that kind of society on that basis of that kind of identity, we're in great shape.
Oh, wow. I'm life that wills to live amidst life that wills to live. Well, that's a great summary of this conversation, and it's profound. Well, Jeremy, if people are excited about you and things they've heard today, where can they find you and your books and such?
Oh, yeah. Well, if you go to my website, jeremylent.com, you'll see a lot of information about my book, The Patterning Instinct. And soon there'll be information up there about my new book coming out next spring that I mentioned earlier, called The Web of Meaning. And the second place you can check out my work is my blog, which is at patternsofmeaning.com. That's easy to remember. And there often I'll write articles about what's going on in the world right now, like such as coronavirus or ecological destruction, whatever it might be, but always within the context of these deeper questions of our place of meaning in life.
Excellent. Wow. Jeremy, this is so amazing. I really, really grateful for this conversation. And again, shout out to Annalise for the connection.
Yeah, thank you, Annalise. A dear friend of mine too. Wonderful person. So glad that we have that shared friend.
Wonderful. Well, thank you again.
It's been a pleasure to be in this conversation. Thank you so much. I feel like we've really explored some deep and very meaningful questions through this. So I thank you for it.
Thank you again for listening to this episode of Fractal Friends with Jeremy Lent. You can find more content, links, and resources about this episode, as well as other episodes, at fractalfriends.us. And while you're there, sign up for the newsletter to get updates on new episodes and learn more about my work as a conflict transformation catalyst. And also consider signing up to be a patron of Fractal Friends. You can do that at fractalfriends.us or at patreon.com/fractalfriends. You can find more about Jeremy at jeremylent.com or check out his blog at patternsofmeaning.com. And you can learn more about me, Duncan Autry, at duncanautry.com. And check out the company that I started with the past Fractal Friends guest, Ala Weinberg. We are called Spoke and Wheel, the workplace relationship experts. Our website is spokeandwheel.co. Schedule a call with us. We would love to talk about how we can work with you. If you like this episode, please take a moment to share it with someone. Text it to a friend, post it on Facebook, send an email to a bunch of people. I'm doing my part to amplify these voices, and I would love to have your support in spreading the word. And as usual, I'm going to close this out with a song. The song I want to share with you is called What Do We Do Now? By an upcoming guest on Fractal Friends, Austin Willisey. What do we do now? What can we learn? What can we change now? These are questions that are asked in the song, and these are exactly the questions that we all need to be asking right now. Thank you for listening to Fractal Friends, and remember, we all have a role to play in the whole. Have a nice day.
Listen.